the importance of family and continuity and community above personal gratification of the individual. This is what the institution of levirate marriage, when it is permitted, was meant to reflect. But personal gratification was exactly what motivated the Herodians, just as it motivated Claudius in the play. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 73, Hamlet and the Herodians. I'm Mayor Soloveitchik. Shakespeare's Hamlet is perhaps the most famous play ever written, and many are familiar with the plot. Prince Hamlet of Denmark is visited by the ghost of his dead father, the late king, who reveals that he, the king, had been murdered by his brother Claudius, who not only then became king, but also married Hamlet's mother, Gertrude. This revelation sets Hamlet on a path that destroys his relationships and ends with the death of most of the main characters. What is often missed, however, is that Hamlet in the play is already in deep depression before he meets his father's ghost, before he learns of the regicide of his father, the king. Hamlet is already profoundly upset by the fact that his mother, Gertrude, widowed only a month, had married her brother-in-law, Hamlet's uncle Claudius, a relationship that Hamlet calls incest. Hamlet says, "A little month, or ere those shoes were old with which she followed my poor father's body, like Niobe all tears, why she, even she, O God, a beast that wants discourse of reason would have mourned longer. Married with mine uncle, my father's brother, but no more like my father than I to Hercules, within a month, ere yet the salt of most unrighteous tears had left the flushing in her galled eyes, she married. O most wicked speed to post with such dexterity to incestuous sheets. It is not, nor it cannot come to good, but break my heart, for I must hold my tongue." As the scholar Jason Rosenblatt has written, this aspect of the plot of Hamlet can only be fully understood if one bears biblical marriage laws in mind. Leviticus states that one is forbidden from marrying one's brother's widow, but Deuteronomy emphasizes an exception known as levirate marriage. If one's brother has died and left no children, then, according to the Bible, one was allowed, in the biblical age often expected, to marry the widow and through the children produced by that marriage ensure familial continuity. But again, that is only true if the dead brother had no children. If he had children through the marriage, then it is forbidden for one to marry the widow of one's deceased brother. Or to apply this to Hamlet, because Hamlet's father had children, Claudius was not allowed to marry Gertrude. The English in Shakespeare's time would have been well aware of this law, for it was at the center of the controversy surrounding Henry VIII's attempt to abrogate his marriage to Catherine of Aragon. Catherine had been married originally to Henry VIII's brother, though that marriage produced no children. Thus, as Rosenblatt writes, for Claudius and Gertrude to marry would have been permitted by the Bible only if Hamlet did not exist, only if no children had been produced by Gertrude's original marriage. Thus, in marrying Claudius, Hamlet's mother was acting as if she was nullifying Hamlet's own existence, which is, at the beginning of the play, the source of Hamlet's profound depression. Indeed, at the beginning of the play, Claudius notes Hamlet's sadness and asks him, "How is it that the clouds still hang on you?" And Hamlet replies, "Not so, my lord. I am too much in the sun." This is a pun, for Shakespeare is the greatest punster in English, with the possible exception of the person who writes headlines for the New York Post. Here, Hamlet is ostensibly speaking of the sun, S-U-N, but in saying, "I am too much in the sun," he is emphasizing that he is a son, S-O-N, of the deceased king. That deceased king had a son, and that is why the marriage of the queen to her brother-in-law was forbidden. Thus, the rules of levirate marriage are part of the plot of Hamlet, but not only of Hamlet. In a strange and striking way, Hamlet's plot is partially paralleled in a story reported by Josephus, a tale that unfolded in the first years of the post-Herodian era in Jerusalem. We have seen how Herod's death was preceded by the execution of his eldest son, Antipater, with Herod passing away 5 days later. After much lobbying with Augustus by potential heirs, the kingdom of Herod was divided up amongst some of the king's other children, with one, Archelaus, being granted the title of ethnarch, or governor of the region of Yehudah, Judea. Archelaus, in turn, proceeded to do something that shocked the populace, something that is relevant to the plot of Hamlet. He married the widow of his dead half-brother Alexander, who had also been married to and widowed from another. Because Alexander had had children, Archelaus's relationship with Alexander's widow would have been considered absolutely forbidden. Thus Josephus writes, quote, "When Archelaus was entered on his ethnarchy and was come into Judea, he accused Joatsar the son of Boethus of assisting the seditious, and took away the high priesthood from him, and put Eleazar his brother in his place. He also magnificently rebuilt the royal palace that had been at Jericho, and he diverted half the water." Josephus writes of Archelaus as follows, quote, "Moreover, he transgressed the law of our fathers, and married Glaphyra, the daughter of Archelaus, who had been the wife of his brother Alexander, which Alexander had three children by her, while it was a thing detestable among the Jews to marry the brother's wife," end quote. Thus did Archelaus commit the same sin as Claudius. Josephus further emphasizes that Archelaus even divorced his own first wife in order to marry his sister-in-law, and that he was driven to do so entirely by desire, or as Josephus puts it, so great was his affection for this Glaphyra. Archelaus's governing of Jerusalem lasted 10 years until around the year 6, and then he was summoned to Rome because news of his tyrannical ways had reached the emperor. Or as Josephus further puts it, "In the 10th year of Archelaus's government, both his brethren and the principal men of Judea and Samaria, not being able to bear his barbarous and tyrannical usage of them, accused him before Caesar, and that especially because they knew had broken the command of Caesar, which obliged him to behave with moderation among them," end quote. Augustus, the emperor of Rome, was apparently less fond of Archelaus than he was of his father Herod, and Augustus summarily banished Archelaus to the faraway region of Gaul. Now here, ladies and gentlemen, is where the story gets a bit more eerie. Josephus further reports that both Archelaus and his forbidden spouse had had dreams at around this point. First, Archelaus, Tetrarch of Jerusalem, before being summoned by Augustus, experienced some sort of vision in the night, one which seemed to portend his political doom, at least as interpreted by a member of a Jewish sect now known as the Essenes, whom we will discuss in a later lecture. This is Josephus' account, describing the dream of Archelaus. Quote, "Now before Archelaus was gone up to Rome upon this message, he related this dream to his friends, that he saw ears of corn in number 10, full of wheat, perfectly ripe, which ears, as it seemed to him, were devoured by oxen. And when he was awake and gotten up, because the vision appeared to be of great importance to him, he sent for the diviners, whose study was employed about dreams. And while some were of one opinion and some of another, for all their interpretations did not agree, Simon, a man of the sect of the Essenes, desired leave to speak his mind freely, and said that the vision denoted a change in the affairs of Archelaus, and that not for the better, that oxen, because that animal takes uneasy pains in his labors, denoted affliction, and indeed denoted further a change of affairs, because that land which is plowed by oxen cannot remain in its former state, and that the ears of corn being 10 determined the like number of years, because an ear of corn grows in 1 year, and that the time of Archelaus's government was over. And thus did this man expound the dream." End quote. Ears of corn, 10 in all, devoured by oxen, denoting that the 10 years of rulership by Archelaus had come to a close. Of course, when we read this, we think immediately of a different dream, one that psychologically might have inspired the dream of Archelaus himself, and that is the famous story in Genesis of Pharaoh, whose dreams of 7 cows that devour portend the disaster of famine yet to come, and whose number 7 represents 7 years. Thus, one need not be a brilliant interpreter of dreams in order to understand the foreboding that might have motivated Archelaus' nightmare. Perhaps he sensed he was in trouble with the emperor. We cannot know. But then there is the reported dream of his sister-in-law, whom he had married, in violation of Torah law. She, we are told by Josephus, had a vision of her deceased first husband coming to her. Or as Josephus puts it, she thought she saw Alexander standing by her, at which she rejoiced and embraced him with great affection, but that he complained to her. End quote. And Josephus adds that he accused her as follows. "Didst not thou pledge thy faith to me, and wast not thou married to me when thou wast a virgin, and had we not children between us? Yet hast thou forgotten the affection I bore to thee out of a desire of a second husband? Nor hast thou been satisfied with that injury thou didst me, but thou hast been so bold as to procure thee a third husband to lie by thee in an indecent and imprudent manner, hast entered into my house, and hast been married to Archelaus, thy husband, and my brother. However, I will not forget thy former kind affection for me, but will set thee free from every such reproachful action and cause thee to be mine again, as thou once wast. And Josephus concludes, when she had related this to her female companions, in a few days' time she departed this life. End quote. Reading this, I was struck by the similarity of this story to the plot of Hamlet. Violations of biblical marriage laws, visions of deceased husbands, and of course, tragic ends. And while Shakespeare was certainly drawing on earlier versions of the Hamlet story in producing his play, I could not help but wonder whether he had read this story in Josephus, a text that would have been accessible to him. We cannot know for sure, but it is striking to note that whereas Hamlet and the Herodians give us forbidden versions of marriage, the Davidic dynasty, as described in the Bible, has extended versions of levirate marriage in its origins in various forms, most famous in the Ruth and Boaz story. And we must understand what this institution means for the Bible. Leon Cass, in his book on Genesis, reflected as follows, quote, if we are willing to set aside for the moment our current sensibilities, we may be able to discover and even appreciate the principles that inform this ancient custom. For details aside, the practice of levirate marriage seeks to uphold what is centrally important in marriage altogether. The heart of marriage, especially but not only biblically speaking, is not primarily a matter of the heart. Rather, it is primarily about procreation and even more about transmission of a way of life. Husband and wife, whether they know it or not, are incipiently father and mother, parents of children for whose moral and spiritual education they bear a sacred obligation. In levirate marriage, all those crucial principles are defended. A man serves literally as his brother's keeper. He refuses to allow his brother to die without a trace. Also, he refuses to nullify his sister-in-law's marriage, vindicating her claim to motherly fulfillment within her marriage. Taking seriously the commandment, be fruitful and multiply, levirate marriage elevates the importance of progeny above personal gratification, and hence the importance of lineage and community above the individual. End quote. The importance of family and continuity and community above personal gratification of the individual. This is, according to Cass, what the institution of levirate marriage, when it is permitted, was meant to reflect. But personal gratification was exactly what motivated the Herodians, just as it motivated Claudius in the play. And thus we are not to be surprised at what transpired with Herod's son in Jerusalem. And all too soon, this dynasty at the end of the Second Temple period will cease to rule, and Jerusalem will remain, for Jews, David's city forever. This is Mayor Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.